All right. It is the first Sunday of Lent, so you can pick up those packages for your kids right out there on the table where you check them in. It's the six-week season leading up to Easter. And for our Lenten sermon series, we're talking about just some of the foundational disciplines of our faith, because we are in a time when we need sturdy, resilient, convictional church, to use Dr. David Gushee's phrase. And our core Christian values and practices are meant to help shape us for this task. So last week, we looked a little bit at pilgrimage, and we talked about that as both the physical journeys that we can take as acts of pilgrimage, as well as the inward journey of pilgrimage, as a place where we can go inward to find refreshment and empowerment and commune with God. And this week, we're going to talk about acts of service, but I'm going to come at it from maybe a little bit different angle than usual. I'm going to use a story from the beginning of the book of John, the Gospel of John, to frame things. But before we get into the story, I thought it might help us to understand it a little bit better if we talk briefly about the text that we call the Gospel of John. So we know, like, as a genre, there are four Gospels, and those Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they're biographical, meaning they're meant to tell us about the life of Jesus, right? But they're not biographical in the way that we might think of biography today. I don't know about I'm kind of a history nerd, so I read a lot of biographies. I'm currently in the middle of listening to the old one about John Adams, right? But it's like the Gospels are not a biography, like those nerdy biographies of John Adams and General Ulysses S. Grant that I really like, right? Or even like Maria Callas. I read a whole bunch. It doesn't matter. Enough about me. The Gospels do contain historical accounts, like those sort of biographical accounts do, but they're also intended to paint a picture, right? Not just about what Jesus did or what he taught, but why the writers thought he mattered. They were written to proclaim why Jesus and what he came to do was good news, right? That word gospel just means good news. And so this story's coming from the good news of John, the Gospel of John. So the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, these were all composed many years after the life of Jesus, a few decades. Mark is the earliest, John was thought to be the latest. And the writers, when they wrote them down, they relied on different oral traditions and probably some written documents that had been circulating in the house churches at the time. So many of the Gospels are also written, it's thought, in relation to one another. So the first three in particular, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, those are called the Synoptic Gospels. They have a lot of overlap in some of the stories that they tell, but they're telling them from maybe with a few different shades or maybe a little additional information based on the author's personal memories. Most scholars agree that Matthew and Luke used Mark as probably a template in writing their accounts. So Mark was the earliest. If you read it, it's the shortest. It's the most like succinct. It's like boom, boom, boom. A lot of people like Mark for that reason. You see, Matthew and Luke have a little bit more extrapolation. Matthew and Luke also seem to have had another common written source that they were probably using that we no longer have. And that's getting into like the weeds of theology. We don't need to go that deep. But for those of you who are really nerdy, that source that they speculate existed, they call Q, or Q source, not QAnon. Just want to make that distinction. But it's sometimes called Q. So all that to say, the four Gospels that exist, John's is the most distinctive, right? It's pretty different than Matthew, Mark, and Luke. There's no parables in the book of John. It's often described as being a little bit more mystical. I like to say I'm a little bit more cautious about teaching the Gospel of John because it was written significantly later than the others, a few decades probably after. And it was written during a time when there were some growing tensions between Judaism and then the part of Judaism that became Christianity, right? So at that time, we were still all part of the same tradition, but there were some increased political pressures after the fall of Jerusalem in 80 or 70 CE that was putting some extra pressures on some internal strain. And I think that John is a little less careful about distinguishing his frustration with certain leaders or maybe certain strains of the faith from sort of the entirety, right? Does that make sense? Like, if I'm relating to that, it's not apples to apples, but be like if I'm expressing a lot of, like, frustration with Christianity today, right? And it's not all Christianity, right? But boy, there's a pretty nice little swath of it that's gotten deep into white Christian nationalism, and it's pretty frustrating. But John isn't, he's not writing in a time where he's needing to be that careful. I think people understood what he meant, but because it has less care there, that gospel's often been weaponized and used by people who are anti-Jewish throughout history. Right, so that said, it's one that I handle and I have to unpack a little bit sometimes when I preach from it, but it also has my absolute favorite resurrection account. And I think John is really beautiful. I think John understands the literary tradition and imagery of his own faith tradition in a way that I think stands out from the others. And so I often preach from John, like, you know, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, right? That's connecting Genesis all the way through to the big story. I preach from John on Easter because, man, that resurrection story is just a masterpiece. But because John was the last to write his gospel, it was thought that he was aware of the other gospels, that they had already been written and were circulating in the early church. And so John was looking at those. He's like, okay, yeah, we know those stories, but I want to write a few extra stories to sort of complement those with a different perspective. And so that's why many of the stories and teachings that we see in John don't appear in the other gospels. Also, his stories and his language are highly symbolic at times. They tend to have layers of meaning. He's trying to communicate on lots of levels. Right, so with that understanding, let's look at our story for today. This is one that's unique to the Gospel of John. It's a story about Jesus that's set right at the beginning of his ministry. So John places it right after his baptism and the calling of the first disciples. And then in John chapter 2, we enter with this. And the portion, this early portion of the book of John, centers on what we call seven signs. There are seven miracles that were intended to reveal something unique about Jesus. So if you Google the seven signs of John, you'll find those. But today we're going to be looking at the first of these signs and what Jesus seems to be telling us about Jesus through it. So if you're following along, this is John 2, 1 to 6. So on the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. And when the wine gave out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what concern is that to me and you? My hour has not yet come." And his mother said to the servants, "Just do whatever he tells you." Right, so I think before we go on, maybe we can just take a moment to appreciate this very real, relatable human dynamic between a mother and son, right? Mom's like, could you get up and do something about that? And he's a little bit like, what I saw in my head was like Napoleon Dynamite. Gosh, you know? And then Mary is like, I'm his mother. And she looks at everybody, he's going to do it. Just do what he tells you, because, you know, he's going to do what his mama says. You can just kind of hear Jesus sighing, right? They're at this wedding together. Some of Jesus' friends are there. Apparently the groom, who's responsible for providing for the guests in this context, the groom has run out of wine. And in the ancient world, this was a huge faux pas. Hospitality is a major cultural value. To not provide that when it was expected could result not just in embarrassment, but social disgrace, even financial calamity. There's potential for the family of the bride to sue the family of the groom if they think that they've been shirking on their social responsibilities. So shame and honor culture, this situation would bring the family shame. So apparently Mary is aware of the problem, and she's invested in solving it. Now, why she's invested in that, we have no idea. You know, maybe she's related to the groom's family. Maybe the mother of the groom is a really good friend of hers, but whatever the case, she sees and notices that disaster is about to befall this family if it comes out that they've run out of wine. And she also senses somehow that her son might be able to do something about that. And we're not told what she has in mind. Like, we're not actually sure what she thinks he can do. It doesn't tell us. And Jesus does seem to resent her asking a little. Right? He's like, "Why is this my problem? It's not my time," is what he says. And when he says that, he's using language that John picks up later in his gospel when he's describing the part of Jesus' life when Jesus is arrested and eventually crucified, right? That was Jesus' time, John tells us. And when we were working through some of the David stories in January and February, we were talking a little bit about discerning what's ours to do and what is not ours to do and the timing of those things. And it does seem like Jesus here is saying, this isn't mine to do, not yet, not now, not quite yet, but he's going to do what his mom asks him to do, right? And so if Jesus' mother is offended by his response to her, she doesn't seem to take it to heart. Right, she just kind of takes another approach. She addresses the workers. She tells them, follow any directions Jesus gives you. And part of me wonders if she just knows her son, right? That he might not be willing to do something miraculous to help her out, but if the servants ask for help, he's not going to turn them down, right? Maybe he's a little bit of a sucker for some underdogs in trouble that does seem consistent with Jesus, right? So John doesn't tell us why Mary thinks now is the moment, why Jesus doesn't agree with her. He just tells us here how the story plays out. So this is John 2, 6 through 11. So it's now standing there were six stone water jars for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. And Jesus said to them, fill the jars with water. They filled them up to the brim. He said, now draw some out and take it to the person who's in charge of the banquet. And so they took it. And when the person in charge tasted the water, that it had become wine and did not know where it came from, it's as though the servants who had drawn the water knew. That person called the bridegroom and said to him, everyone serves the good wine first and the inferior wine after the guests are already drunk, right? Like, that's the way to do it. But you kept the good wine until now. John says, Jesus did this, the first of his signs in Cana of Galilee, and revealed his glory, and the disciples believed in him. Right, so in spite of whatever earlier ambivalence he has, he ends up working with the party staff to turn the water into wine. It's one of his most famous miracles. It was certainly one of my favorites in high school that I would like to point out to my parents because they didn't keep any alcohol around them. But Jesus, like, I mean, it's like his first miracle. I don't know. John says this is the first of his signs. If it's intended to be a sign, if it's not supposed to just be like a cool party trick that he's doing, what was that sign supposed to reveal? I think there's lots of ways we could answer that, as John, he's always kind of layered. But I just want to point out a couple of things that I noticed that might be a little bit like sources of sustenance for us in this moment. So let's consider who the sign was for. From the story, we can tell this was not a sign for everybody at the party. Right? It wasn't a sign for Jesus' mother. She didn't need a sign to know that her son was special. She already knew. She's like, get up and do something. Sign's not for her. The sign wasn't for the wedding guests, right? All the people who were attending the wedding, they were none the wiser that any of this had gone down, right? They're just up there enjoying themselves. They're eating and drinking and making merry. It wasn't for the men in charge of the party who tasted the wine, right? The steward, the party planner. He just said, wow, this is the best wine I've tasted at the end of a wedding. He's like, come get the groom. And he's like, strong flex, man. Saving the best for last. Way to go. He didn't question the origin. The sign was not for him. The sign also wasn't for the hosts or the bride or the groom. None of them seemed to be aware this happened. The sign was for the servers. Right? The sign was for the servers. Jesus gave them a task. Go, fill these stone jars with water. And we imagine this probably would have taken a while. These were big jars. This is 20 to 30 gallons each. It's probably multiple trips to the well and back, right? Carrying buckets, emptying them in, several people, back and forth, and back and forth, and back and forth. And they did this task, and in the tedium of it, they bore witness to the transformation of water to wine. And then it was these same servers who then took this wine and went up and served the guests and enabled the blessing of this miracle, this very fine drink. They were able to bless all of those who were in the rest of the party. And I think this tells us a couple of things about the Christian discipline of acts of service, right? That it's through service, John tells us, the transformation often happens. It's through acts of service that we have the opportunity to see the power of God revealed on earth. It's through acts of service that we see this rich blessing of God dispensed to others. right? That we witness the kingdom of God unfolding as we participate, right? It's not always a big showy ordeal, this good realm of God coming forth. It's not like God's sitting in the sky with a great big wand and just says, poof, let's make it better. For whatever reason, God has chosen to work with humanity to bring forth God's good realm on earth so that we have a choice in our participation of it. And it's in the daily grind. It's this back and forth to the well. It's like my arms are achy. Oh my gosh, it seems like I'm getting tired. It's the 10th load of laundry that you've run for your family this week that God starts to show up, right? And Christianity calls us not just to belief, but to see ourselves in participation with God. And that spiritual discipline of serving can come up in all kinds of ways, right? It can be hospitality, serving a meal to your neighbors, just general acts of kindness, working behind the scenes in an organization or a business. It can be coaching the little league team, teaching Sunday school, making bread, helping with the Zoom, technicalities online, right? It's doing all of these little things. It's dispensing and cooking food at places like Hope Clinic. Serving places us in proximity to the divine's transforming work. As I was writing this, I kept thinking about St. Ignatius of Loyola. So if you know anything about St. Ignatius, he was the founder of the Jesuits. And I also think that he would encourage us to see even the menial tasks that we do, or things that seem menial, mowing the lawn. Maybe you're the person in your office that makes sure that the plants are watered every week. Maybe you're the person in your family that makes sure that the dog gets food, right? That we can see all of these little things as acts of service that we do as unto God. And that when we view them that way, instead of just like the drudgery of everyday life, if we view those as acts of service springing out of a place of love for our families and our colleagues and our neighbors, that helps us transform our understanding of ourselves and of what we're doing. Because Jesus tells us the kingdom of God, it's not like some big explosion. It's like a little tiny piece of yeast that's making its way through a loaf of bread, right? You don't always see it right away. See, it's just, like, it looks like just like a blob of dough that's sitting there sometimes. It's not impressive. But if you watch it slowly over time, you see something is actually happening, right? The dough is actually rising, but we have to have eyes to see it. So I think serving isn't just about helping others, although it is that, right? We are all interdependent on one another, but serving is helping others, and it's a spiritual discipline that helps to form us, to open our eyes to see how the Spirit of love works and moves in this world. It's through us. It's through the small things. There's an Irish writer I've grown to love. This is not in my notes, but Magda turned me on to her. She wrote this book called Small Things Like These. It's a really beautiful novella, and it's just talking, it's the small little things that we do that are advancing the kingdom of God when we see that. Another thing I think we note here, too, is Jesus aligned himself with the workers in the story. Right? I think it was an act of solidarity with the people who were carrying out these tasks, the people who may have borne the wrath of the partygoers and the host if there's no more wine. Right? Any of you guys ever worked customer service? I did retail. I kind of loved retail. But you know, things that are out of your control, people often take out on you. And I think Jesus places himself alongside those for whom could have borne that wrath. And this is a theme that we see throughout Jesus' ministry, right? His humbleness, his support for, his identification with the vulnerable, with people who have less social status. And when I look at Jesus, I think, man, that man was not too good for anything. Right, that guy washed feet, he fed the hungry, he slept on the ground, he touched the untouchable, he stood up for people being bullied, the woman who was about to be stoned. Right, he included other people who people didn't want around, and he not only included them, he called them friend. Right, he was saying, I am a friend of God this morning. There's something really profound. It doesn't matter what your background is, it doesn't matter what you've done, it doesn't matter who you are, your sexual orientation, it doesn't matter. You're a friend of God. Right, and in that, Jesus is modeling this humility. Jesus himself becomes this person who comes down to serve us. He becomes one with us. That is the solidarity. He calls us to do the same if we follow him and his way of being in the world. And then John tells us that when we do that, that's when we witness the power of God breaking forth. And that brings me to the last thing I want to observe this morning about what this first sign revealed about Jesus and what he came to do. He came to connect us with abundant joy. He came to connect us with abundant joy. And that does not mean you need to be happy all the time. You don't need to come into church with a smile on your face, acting happy, clappy. That isn't what it means. It means that we understand that God's heart for God's people is that we have a source of refreshment and joy when we're in need of it. We understand that the work of God isn't meant to be a drudgery that we endure, like self-flagellating Puritans, right? It's meant to bring us life. And I think John is making that proclamation here when he starts with this story of turning water into wine at a giant wedding, right? Jesus' coming is a joyful event. He said, yeah, the work might be tedious at times, but it is in service of a much larger celebration. John tells us God's presence in this world is an active agent. It's a source of nourishment for the soul. It's a source of nourishment that should overflow to our friends and to our families. You know, there's a lot we could say about the symbolism of wine in the Bible, but just at its most basic, wine is present at celebrations, right? And Jesus does not disappoint. The wine is flowing readily here at this joyous event. If you do the math, he's making 120 to 150 gallons of choice wine. That's a lot of wine. I don't know if any of you were like me in college and you bought those giant gallons of wine for Meijer, or maybe you still do, for sangria, please, but you know, 120 to 150 gallons. And the steward's like, I've done a lot of weddings. This stands out. And the value of what's been produced here is immense. Right? It reminds us that the divine's provision for us is extravagant. God's heart for us is to bless us and to be extravagant. Now, certainly this isn't true for everybody, but I talk to a lot of you, and I know many of you are running on some fumes these days. And you might be like, Emily, I relate more to the wine cellars in the beginning of this, the ones that are empty. Right? The wine cellars have no more wine. Maybe we're feeling depleted. Maybe we're feeling like there's nothing left to serve. We're feeling a little bit like I haven't been relaxed or rested or hopeful in a long time. I'm feeling like there's anxiety that's cackling in the air. Some of us might even be a little depressed. And some of us might be finding that our hurt and our disappointment and our frustration is fermenting into cynicism and despair, even nihilism. Just looking at things and feeling like, I don't even know if any of this matters anyway, so just burn it all down. But you know, I think Jesus invites us to something different. I think he's not so much a burn it all down kind of guy as a let's have an even bigger, better party kind of guy. And I think John's telling us the Spirit likes to ferment things that bring life. The Spirit wants to ferment hope. The Spirit wants to ferment joy. And the divine is calling us to be refueled, to imagine that, to prophetically imagine different outcomes to stories that seem dire, right? Jesus does not just provide what's needed. It's saying that he provides extravagantly in service of that vision, right? That he doesn't just make up for the lack of wine, that he's filling these jars to the brim, overflowing with the best wine, probably with some left over. Because I have to tell you, if there's not any wine left over, then some of those wedding attendees are sleeping on the floor. You know, that's a lot of wine. It reminds me of the other story about the wine, or about the fish and the bread, right? Everybody's hungry. Jesus has this miracle. Everybody gets enough, more than enough, and then there's some left over. Right? This isn't trying to tell us, I mean, I'm not like a prosperity gospel person. I don't think that we should be running around with like, you know, blingy rings and private jets. I remember when I first went into ministry, especially when I was having to raise my own funds, I felt like God said, you will always have more than enough. More than enough doesn't necessarily mean you get to buy everything you want to buy. More than enough means that if God's asked you to do a task, God's going to provide enough and a little bit more for you to be able to do that task. Does that make sense? Like maybe all you really need is a fish and a piece of bread, and that's more than enough to keep you going. Maybe you were able to take an extra fish so that you can eat it along the way, but some of this refueling is like, God, I know some of this just feels like I'm taking the wine and the water and I'm blowing back and forth and I'm exhausted, but give me eyes to see and enough fuel to keep going because I'm doing it in service of this prophetic imagination that there's something better ahead and that that's what you've promised us. right? The spiritual discipline of service isn't meant to drain us. It's not meant to make us feel like, oh gosh, I should go out. I feel guilty. I should go out and volunteer more. That's not what it is. It's helping us see what we're already doing in service of God, which should be an encouragement to us, because hopefully then we can see the small miracles playing out with our kids, with our families, in the classrooms, right? When it's rooted in God, it's meant to lead us to a sense of abundance. Jesus comes to bring freedom and love and joy to these places of despair that we're feeling. He came to bring honor to our places of shame or potential shame. And this work is meant to be a wellspring of grace for us, not a burden. He says, my yoke is easy, my burden is light. It's not meant to be a burden. It is supposed to be a wellspring of grace. And I think that's good news that we can receive. So right after service, Elle is going to be leading that post-inauguration processing group, looking at some of what Bonhoeffer, we were looking at Bonhoeffer's advice to pray and act in these times, right? What's mine to do, what's not mine to do? The TLC group is also going to talk about this a bit too. When they emailed me, I thought, you know, John chapter 2 here is a great reminder that when the Spirit invites us to take action, we're doing it with the abundance of God in our souls, the power of God at our back, and the presence of God leading us and surrounding us. All right, with that, let's do a little meditation this morning. And we often do a little silence or guided meditation. This morning, let's do a guided one. You don't have to do this, but you are always invited to just, you know, take some deep breaths, relax. Let's spend at first just a little moment here, just picturing yourself in a place where you feel peaceful. Maybe it's a real place that you know of, maybe it's a place that's in your imagination, but let's just rest in that place. I invite you to imagine too that Jesus just comes up and stands or sits next to you. I invite you just to have a conversation, if you'd like. Like, help me to see where you're at work. Or maybe you're like, I just need to sit here with you and feel some refreshment and some hope and some joy. So I invite you, if you want to take this time to do that, I'll let you know when some time is up. But Lord, just help us, refresh us. Spirit, I ask that you would just be a source of continuing refreshment for us when we need it, that we would understand that your heart toward us is one of helping equip us to give us joy, to give us strength and perseverance for the journey. I ask that you would give us eyes to see where you're at work behind the scenes. Give us eyes to see how you're already at work in the things that we're doing. Help us to understand this transformation. May we enjoy the new wine that you are creating, and that we can use that to bless those around us. Amen.